Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the petulant outburst today by Donald Trump, which the reality TV showman staged by bringing the press into the Oval Office after a private meeting with Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and soon-to-be House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Ben Jacobs, the Washington correspondent covering Congress for The Guardian, where he has an article, Trump Vows to Shut Down Government in Heated Public Row with Democrats, joins us to discuss Trump's most meaty bone yet thrown to his base, in which he proudly stated he would shut down the government to get funding for his border wall, claiming that he would take responsibility for the political risk because he was protecting America's border security. Schumer immediately characterized the stage blow-up as a tantrum by Trump, but with about 10 days to go before the government runs out of money, the dysfunction in Washington could suddenly spread to epic levels. We will assess the likely political consequences of Trump's high-stakes gambit, in which neither side is likely to back down, and whether wasting $5 billion to satisfy an absurd campaign promise by Trump will be a compromise the Democrats will be willing to accept in order to be seen as the only responsible adults left in the room. Then we will speak with Seth Hettner, an award-winning journalist and longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, about his article at the New York Times, The Dangers of Doing Favors for Donald Trump. He joins us to discuss the recent court filing by Robert Mueller and the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, which reveal what could clearly be seen as collusion or conspiracy with a top Russian official close to Putin, who appears to be his spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, offering, quote, political synergy between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. Then finally, we'll look into the naked power grabs underway in Michigan and Wisconsin, where Republican-controlled lame duck legislatures are trying to stymie the will of the people by hamstringing incoming Democrats who were just elected to state offices by passing a flurry of bills aimed at thwarting the incoming officeholders' ability to govern. John Nichols, a Washington correspondent for The Nation, where he has an article, The Republican Party Has Become a Conspiracy to Seize Power, joins us from Madison, Wisconsin. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Ben Jacobs, a D.C.-based political reporter covering Congress for The Guardian, previously a congressional reporter for The Daily Beast. His journalism has been published in The Boston Globe, The New Republic, The Atlantic, and Salon. And his latest article at The Guardian is Trump Vows to Shut Down Government in Heated Public Row with Democrats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Jacobs.
Thanks for having me.
And Ben, it seems to me that that whole outburst today, which of course has been gone viral, if you will, was largely staged because Nancy Pelosi, the soon-to-be majority leader, along with the Senate minority leader, Chuck Schumer, were having a private meeting in the Oval Office. And then Trump summoned in the reporters in. And as soon as they set their cameras up and ready to roll, he then sort of staged this outburst like a reality TV showman, which he is. So am I correct in seeing that in that light?
I mean, there's certainly some element of stage there, but it also was sort of, you know, that it was also the type of spontaneous thing that was contrary to things that Trump had tweeted before. And that put in sort of complicated political territory that he got sort of, you know, that if there's part of it's a stage and he clearly wanted the media there. But when he makes statements about whether Republicans have the votes in the House, when they don't currently have the votes in the House to pass a funding bill with a border wall, it puts him in trouble and puts him in a place where Republicans are now forced to try to back up Trump and greatly diminishes his negotiating leverage in this.
Well, let's actually play the clip itself, at least the part that has gotten everybody's attention.
One thing I think we can agree on is we shouldn't shut down the government over a dispute. And you want to shut it down. You keep talking about it.
The last time, Chuck, you shut it down.
No.
And then you opened it up very quickly. And
20 times.
I don't want to do what you did.
20 times, Chuck, you have called for, I will shut down the government if I don't get my wool. None of us have
said. You want to know something?
You've said it.
Okay, you want to put that on my...
You said it.
I'll take it.
Okay, good.
You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely.
Fair enough.
And I am proud, and I'll tell you what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle of shutting down. And I'm going to shut it down for border security.
But we believe you shouldn't shut it down.
So, Ben, that's it. What's your sense of this high-stakes gamble that Trump has taken on? Was it impetuous, impromptu, or cleverly staged?
I think it was some combination of the first two, that I think taking responsibility for a government shutdown in advance of it happening is never a good negotiating tactic.
But this is the great negotiator, right? The art of the deal.
The book has his name on it, but remember, Tony Schwartz wrote it, not Donald Trump. So that there are questions about how much he took from that, and that this sets up Congress for a really bruising fight over the wall, and that you already have Freedom Caucus Republicans who have insisted that they won't vote for anything without the law. That means they need Democratic votes in the House regardless. And it changes the dynamic when you have so many Republicans who lost their seats and have less to lose and less worries about what Trump does. Not to mention that you have some Republicans who just aren't even showing up at this point that had voted since the midterms. There have been 30 to 40 members who just haven't been showing up on a regular basis.
Well, just in terms of the so-called Freedom Caucus, or the formerly known as the Tea Party, its leader in the House, Mark Meadows, is being touted as a possible replacement for General Kelly, given that Nick Ayers bowed out in a very humiliating retreat from a job that Trump had publicly promised him, or said that he had.
They're certainly tied into Trump, but it's a question of how to get 218. And when you have, so many Republicans, including a outgoing Speaker of the House with what could charitably be described as senioritis, that the math is very difficult for Trump to get what he wants, and this just raises the stakes.
Is it possible that Trump simply, because, his former Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, recently said that he doesn't read briefings, he's out of touch, he doesn't listen, he only has his own ideas, many of them are strange and conspiratorial, and essentially that he's out of control. And, of course, Trump responded by saying that Tillerson's as dumb as a rock. But I think Tillerson, at least he was an eyewitness to much of this dysfunction. Is it possible that this is yet another example of a guy simply not knowing what's going on, not doing the math, not really understanding how the government works?
Certainly, I think he's making a gamble that I think there's some of that. There's also certainly, as he's saying, that he thinks the optics of the government shutdown over a border wall would look good for him, which it's unclear if that's the case. And when you're also reaching a scenario in which that if the government shuts down for more than 12 days, you're going to have a Democratic majority in there, which will immediately pass a clean funding bill. But at this point, you have so many people in Congress on both sides of Capitol Hill who are just ready to go home for Christmas, that a shutdown most importantly means they have to stay in Washington, D.C. And that's going to be the type of energy that happens. And it will just be a question whether Trump can find a way to claim he won, which he's done on a number of occasions, including negotiations with North Korea, where Trump will say he got everything he wanted when he didn't, and hope folks accept that.
So we've got 10 days to go. And, of course, when you talk about them wanting to get out of town, that's one of the issues that's going on with the Senate Majority Leader, McConnell, is it not, over one of the rare bipartisan bills that they have, which is essentially sentencing reform with federal prisons?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that looks like that there's enough pressure for McConnell McConnell to do it, that, and they'll put it at the floor. And the question is whether the proponents of that legislation, the Republican caucus, will make life difficult for everybody else. That it clearly, you know, has pretty much lockstep Democratic support. The Democratic concerns are that the legislation doesn't go far enough. But majority of Republicans in the Senate support it. It has a clear majority support in the House. And the question is whether a handful of sort of tough-on-crime Republicans like Tom Cotton in Arkansas are going to slow down the works that much that it'll get passed. It's just a question of how much time it'll take now that it's going on the floor.
So I imagine that Trump feels that immigration has been one of his best issues, at least the stance that he's taken. And the Democrats don't have a coherent plan short of saying that we need comprehensive immigration. And it even played out considerably in the Beto O'Rourke race down in Texas against Ted Cruz. It's very much an issue that favors the hardline Republican stage because it does seem that there's a general perception in this country that somehow the southern border is out of control, even though so much of what Trump is doing is a gross exaggeration, and deploying the military before the election was such a flagrant abuse of the military, using them as props in a phony, ginned-up election issue. So do you think he's onto something, or do you think he's overplayed his hand?
It's a little bit of both. That certainly what Trump's rhetoric on immigration helped the Republicans in some seats during the midterms and saved some seats, but it also cost them others. That there's a certain appeal that the rhetoric has, but it's been a clear negative sort of across the Sun Belt and in suburban areas. And in contrast, you know, that when you talk to Democrats, that they'll point to seats like one in southern Minnesota where rhetoric on the caravan does, that it shores up Trump's base, but we're sort of going a little bit beyond the base in where that goes, that it helps Trump with the people who already really like him. It doesn't do much and possibly hurts him with the folks who are unclear about how they feel.
So does that mean that we just have political amnesia in this country? That it's so obvious that the sending the military down to the border was a hoax and a con and an abuse of the commander-in-chief's power. And this caravan has been largely a non-event. It's certainly not an invasion from the Middle East, which is the way Trump characterized it.
Mm-hmm. No, but I think that the rhetoric and the issue resonates with a certain slice of Americans, but not with everyone. And the thing about Trump is that Trump, you know, that if we're now at an age of narrow casting, and there's hardcore folks who really like Trump and everything he's saying, that he's not going for a broad audience to sort of please a broad audience, that he's going for sort of particular slices and particular segments who really like him, that it's a far more he's going for hardcore fans, not sort of casual supporters. And this works for that.
Well, just in closing, is that what's happening then with this gambit of shutting down the government to get his wall, which I think you've made a clear case, Ben Jacobs, that it's not going to work? His own party in the House doesn't have the votes in this lame duck session, and as soon as the Democrats come in, it becomes totally irrelevant. So is he risking all because he's panders to this base?
I don't think he's risking all because he can't do anything but pander to his base. He's dancing with the ones that brought him, that when you talk about all the things about when Trump would pivot to being more presidential, when Trump would do something on infrastructure, that Trump is doing, you know, that this is sort of consistent with his behavior, that, you know, that it may not seem consistent outwardly. It's erratic. It certainly appears erratic, but in its own way, it's also still internally consistent, that Trump is still Trump and doing Trumpy things no matter what.
Well, Ben Jacobs, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ben Jacobs, who's a D.C.-based political reporter covering Congress for The Guardian and previously a congressional reporter for The Daily Beast. His journalism has been published in The Boston Globe, The New Republic, The Atlantic, and Salon. And his latest article at The Guardian is Trump Vows to Shut Down Government in Heated Public Row with Democrats. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the latest court filings, which could clearly be seen as collusion or conspiracy between the Trump campaign and top Russian officials close to Putin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Seth Hettner, an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, where he covered numerous stories of political corruption and American war crimes. He's the author of the critically acclaimed books Feasting on the Spoils, The Life and Times of Randy Duke Cunningham, History's Most Corrupt Congressman, and his latest book is Trump, Russia, A Definitive History. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, The Day Dangers of Doing Favors for Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Seth Hettner.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me back.
It's a pleasure to have you back. And the Trump-Russia story, of course, is being updated. These court filings coming from Special Counsel Robert Mueller offer you insight into the mosaics that he's putting together, at least the pieces of the mosaic. But is the mosaic of Trump's involvement with Russia becoming clearer? You've laid it out pretty much in your book. So in many ways, it feels like you and I are waiting for the, the reality to catch up with, in many ways, what's already out there.
Exactly. You know, the way I look at it is that, you know, there are secrets we don't know. There's parts of the story we haven't been filled in yet, but there's no real mystery here. I mean, we know that Trump and Putin have been doing favors for each other for a long time, ever since Trump got into office and before. And, you know, we know that something has happened. And, you know, we don't need Robert Mueller to tell us that this is a national security nightmare.
Well, the national security nightmare may actually worsen. The Russians are building up military forces on the Ukrainian border as we speak. 44 U.S. senators wrote a letter, which is in the Washington Post, Republicans and Democrats, warning about the constitutional crisis and the responsibility of the U.S. Senate to act. But they also mentioned challenges to our national security. So is there a possibility that as Trump basically implodes, the Russians may do something? It could happen within weeks, according to military analysts.
Definitely. They're massing troops and tanks on the border. And, you know, this is a fire keg that's ready to blow. And, you know, that's just one of the many areas where Russia's running rampage around the world without any checks from the U.S. president. You know, the Russians are routinely bombing civilians in Syria. Russians are around the world assassinating dissidents, mostly in the UK. And, you know, right here in the United States, Russians are still interfering in our elections without any kind of check from the U.S. government. So it seems like Trump is giving Putin a free pass to operate at will around the world. And you're absolutely right. It's going to get worse before it gets better.
And you have to add to that list that the Russians sent a couple of bombers to Venezuela, I guess, as a way to tweak the U.S. But in general, though, what would you say would be the connection between, in other words, if you take the assumption that Putin wanted to elect Trump, and he said so at the Helsinki press conference, but in many ways, he and his advisors surely didn't think that Trump was going to win, as most people did. So my sense is that either way, it was a win-win for Putin. If Trump were to lose the election to Hillary Clinton, he'd be going around the country today holding rallies, leading the chant of lock her up, lock her up. So to that extent, Trump, if he's, as the former director of national intelligence said, if he's a asset of Putin in using intelligence terms, where does this asset stand? In other words, is there some buyer's remorse on Putin's part, or is Trump still faithful? In other words, if Putin were to reignite the war in Ukraine and make this kind of cold war a hot war again, would Trump basically roll over as he's usually done?
He seems to be, that seems to be what he's doing, is just rolling over. You know, I think that it's almost as if our American president has a to-do list given to him by Vladimir Putin, and he's just going down and checking things off. You know, he is tearing apart the NATO alliance. You know, we've discussed Russia wreaking havoc around the world. But to your bigger question, is there buyer's remorse? I think Russia and Trump will pay a price for their overt and unseemly over friendliness here. So yes, I think Putin may have been trying to cultivate something, but I think it's blown up. I think, you know, I don't think Donald Trump is capable of being anybody's agent. I think Donald Trump is beyond anybody's control. He seems to not be able to control himself. So I don't know how he could be an agent, because he basically runs around broadcasting his feelings without a filter 24/7. But what I think is happening is that he is susceptible to flattery. I think Trump is not very bright and not very well-versed in international affairs. I think a KGB case officer, and this was the point I think James Clapper was trying to make, that a skilled KGB case officer can easily manipulate a man like Trump. And, you know, we saw that in Helsinki when the two of them met alone in a room against all probably advice that Trump was getting. He seems to be unable to help himself and just keeps getting drawn into compromising situations with Putin. And he's been doing that now for going back years now.
And again, I'm speaking with Seth Heppner, who's an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, where he covered numerous stories of political corruption and American war crimes. He's the author of the critically acclaimed book, Feasting on the Spoils, The Life and Times of Randy Duke Cunningham, History's Most Corrupt Congressman. Although I must say, you may have to update that book with the other corrupt congressman from down there in San Diego, who, believe it or not, got elected, for God's sake, or re-elected, yeah. I should say. And his latest book is Trump, Russia, A Definitive History. And he also has an op-ed at the New York Times, The Dangers of Doing Favors for Donald Trump. Let's talk about, you know, the article starts out in the New York Times talking about Cohen first getting Trump's attention by removing attempts on the condo board of Trump World Towers, where Cohen lived. The residents tried to remove Trump's name from the building, but Cohen intervened and got the board thrown out, and was soon earning a $500,000 salary at Trump Tower. But you say in the article, Seth Heppner, that Mr. Cohen was hired by Trump as a favor to Mr. Cohen's father-in-law, Fema Shusterman, a Ukrainian emigre who had a 1993 conviction for crime related to money laundering. Was he in business with Tamir Sapir, the Soviet emigre who famously rose from being a New York taxi driver to becoming a billionaire?
That's a great question. You know, we don't know the extent of Schusterman's connections. I think they may have had their own sources. But look, all these people in this world of Russian organized crime, they all know each other. This is a relatively small world, so I wouldn't be surprised if they did. You know, it's interesting that when you trace the history of Donald Trump, you can basically write, that's basically what my book is, as a history of Russian organized crime, because Trump has met over time all the major figures in Russian organized crime, have kind of passed through Trump Tower or through his casinos or through his businesses in one way or another.
And that's, of course, back in 1984, David Bogatin, the Russian gangster, bought 5 Trump Tower apartments with $6 million in cash laundered. And, of course, the Atlantic City's Taj Mahal that Trump owned became a favorite money laundering operation for Russian organized crime. But my understanding, just in the broad strategic sense, Seth, is that the Russians, of course, and particularly the KGB, do think long term. And before the Soviet Union collapsed, starting in the mid-1980s, it looks as if they used Russian organized crime through the Jackson-Vanik Amendment. Many of these criminals were posed as Jewish emigres, came over here, set up shop in Brighton Beach, in effect basically creating a beachhead in the United States and fronting for the KGB. They laundered, I understand, up to $800 million of stolen assets from the former Soviet Union.
Yeah, and it's interesting, isn't it interesting that one of their early contacts was Donald Trump? That's kind of the fascinating part of the story, is how early on he catches this wave of Russian criminals that you mentioned coming across. And David Bogatin, you know, the story used to be that, you know, we believe that he came to Trump and said, I have this money, I'd like to buy some apartments. It turns out to be the other way, that Trump had found him. How exactly we found him, we don't know, but Trump had been loosely associated with the world of Italian-American organized crime through his lawyer, Cohen at the time. And he then kind of graduated from Italian-American organized crime into Russian organized crime, and there was a partnership between the two at the time, back in the 80s. So this is a relationship that goes way back, and it's kind of grown over time, and it's grown in severity, and it's grown in intensity. And we have a president who is deeply compromised, to say the least, by all his links to Russia and Russian organized crime.
And you mentioned the lawyer that would, Roy Cohn was the lawyer for the two major Italian mafia families, and then of course his subsequent lawyer is the Michael Cohen, who just
I forgot Roy Cohn's first name. Thanks for reminding me.
Well, but the point being that just last Friday, the special counsel dumped a lot of information, and in court filings, particularly with the Southern District of New York, it's pretty clear that the role that Michael Cohen played in brokering some of these deals between Trump and the Kremlin is much, much deeper than was previously thought. In fact, it puts him absolutely.
And the fascinating thing to me is that everyone in this story is lying. Michael Cohen has pleaded guilty to lying about the extent of these relationships, that he was developing a tower well into the presidential campaign, and he had lied and said that it had stopped before the Iowa caucuses. But everyone else is lying too. George Papadopoulos lied about his contacts in Russia with a mysterious figure who had emails he wanted to get to the campaign. Michael Flynn has lied about his contacts with the Russian ambassador, promising that they would take care of the sanctions problem. I can go on and on here. Paul Manafort is accused of lying about his connections to figures who are connected to mysterious Russians. So everyone around the president seems to be lying. And they're lying about how deep these connections to Russia go. And Michael Cohen has come now and filled in some of these gaps. And, the information is going to continue to come out, because in Robert Mueller's sentencing memorandum, we learned that Michael Cohen has now filled them in about deeper contacts between the Trump Organization executives and Russia that were going on during the campaign. So we are continuing to learn more. It's a picture filling in by the day. But again, there's no real mystery here. That these are two men trying to do favors for each other. What we don't know is what the quid pro quo was.
Well, the fact that Manafort lied and blew up his proffer, his agreement with the special counsel, seems incredibly suicidal and reckless, because now he could spend the rest of his life in jail. So why would he do that? Why do you think he did that, Seth?
That's a great question. I think only Paul Manafort can answer, but I think what it may tell us is that Robert Mueller knows far more than Paul Manafort thought he did, and he was caught unawares of just how deep and how sophisticated Mueller's understanding of the situation is, and maybe he thought he could skate a bit on the truth and spare some of his colleagues, or maybe... there's a lot of speculation that Paul Manafort has something to fear from his Russian contacts, that he was famously in debt to a powerful oligarch, Oleg Deripaska, who's very close to Putin. Deripaska has his own ties to Russian organized crime. He took over the aluminum industry in the 1990s, which was rife with organized crime and murder and bloodshed, and he came out on top. So these are people he may not want to piss off and find a knife in his back while he's in prison. But, we just can't answer. It is a suicidal move, and I just don't know what he was thinking. But it seems clear to me that Robert Mueller has a far more sophisticated understanding of Trump's ties to Russia and Paul Manafort's ties to Russia than Paul Manafort may have believed.
But do you think that Paul Manafort passed this information on to Trump? Obviously, the only card that Manafort has to play is getting a pardon from Trump.
It seems to be what he's angling for. That's his only way out. And I suppose he's throwing himself on Trump's mercy. It's hard to tell. He seems it's the actions of a desperate man, so it's hard to read into it. But, yeah, he definitely was had angered Manafort's team by informing with his so-called joint defense agreement, where he's basically informing on the depth of Mueller's understanding of Russia. And we'll have to see, I guess the proof will be in the pudding. If he gets a pardon, then we know what his strategy was. We'll have to see.
Well, it's extraordinary, though, that the contact that came out of these efforts by Cohen to help Trump get his long-sought Trump Tower in Moscow, because on Trump's first visit to Moscow in 1987, at which his then-wife Ivana acted as his Russian translator, and there's some suggestions that the STB, the Czech intelligence, might have been running her, at least her father was an informant for the STB. But short of that, that's when he first floated the idea of a Trump Tower in Moscow. It seems like that's been the lure that the Russians have been using all along. And for whatever reason, Trump seems to be salivating over that prospect of having his name on the skyline in Moscow.
Yeah, Russia is the well he keeps going back to. And that 1980s trip you mentioned, out of all of Trump's many trips to Russia, including the 2013 one, the 1980s one is the most curious to me, because he's going to the Soviet Union. He's not going to the Russian Federation. He's going to a government that has abolished private wealth. And here he is, a very flashy and flamboyant millionaire being escorted around Moscow. And it just seems that it's that there has to be almost an ulterior motive to this trip. You know, I think buried in the files of the KGB somewhere are the answer, but seems to me he was being studied and evaluated, because he comes back from that trip in 1987 and all of a sudden he's hinting about running for president, and he's attacking the U.S.-Japan alliance, which is a major goal of the KGB at the time. So he is and I think they realized what they had in Donald Trump was a man who's very the same man they have today, a man who's very susceptible to influence and flattery and with a large ego, and can be stroked and groomed and, moved around like a puppet.
Well, the KGB have a term for such people. They're called trusted contacts. And Armand Hammer was one of their trusted contacts. And, of course, he died. And it might well be the case that Trump was the KGB's replacement for Armand Hammer.
Yeah, I think we're going to – the Russia story really – when for me, looking at the history of everything tells you where we are today. And yeah, the Trump's first international overseas development was going to be in Russia. It wasn't going to be in Canada. It wasn't going to be in London, which are kind of more natural destinations. Right away, he's going to Russia. And he keeps coming back to Russia. Something is drawing him back there. Something is pulling him back. He's infatuated or fascinated by it, with all kinds of autocratic rulers. He's taking all kinds of influence and guidance from them. When you step back from the day-to-day of the Mueller investigation, look at the totality of the picture, you really get a fresh perspective that I think is missing from current events, that Trump is deeply compromised and has, national security implications going back decades with his dealings with Russia.
Well, just in closing, in terms of the highlights or the bombshells, if you will, in these court filings, particularly with the Southern District of New York, where Michael Cohen is interacting with somebody they don't name, a top Russian official who promised political synergy. And that in itself is such a smoking gun, because that is the very word that Trump keeps using, collusion, although he ritually says there was no collusion. Well, by nature, that indicates collusion or conspiracy.
Right.
And it looks as though initially there were some thoughts that it was either Dmitry Peskov or the former chief of staff of Putin's, Sergei Ivanov. But it's looking more and more like it was Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. Is that your understanding?
That's my understanding as well, but press secretary really doesn't capture what Dmitry Peskov is. Dmitry Peskov has an intelligence background. He's a deeply connected and influential advisor. He's not Sarah Sanders out there on a podium just reading lines. He is one of Putin's inner circles. So when he's talking to Peskov, he's talking to much more than a press secretary. And I think that context is often missing from the news coverage. But yeah, that's my understanding, that he was talking to Peskov's office.
Well, Seth Hatner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Seth Hatner, who's an award-winning journalist who was a longtime investigative reporter for the Associated Press, where he covered numerous stories of political corruption and American war crimes. He's the author of the critically acclaimed book Feasting on the Spoils, The Life and Times of Randy Duke Cunningham, History's Most Corrupt Congressman. And his latest book is Trump, Russia, A Definitive History. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, The Dangers of Doing Favors for Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the naked power grabs underway in Michigan and Wisconsin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And now joining us now from Madison, Wisconsin, is John Nichols, the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And his latest book with Robert McChesney is Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America. And he has an article at The Nation, The Impeachment of Donald Trump is No Longer Off the Table. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
It is great to be with you, my friend.
Well, thank you, John. And it seems like you're living in a little progressive island in an authoritarian state, at least according to an article in today's New York Times by Paul Krugman, who talks about the one thing that the press have missed in this power grab underway in Madison, Wisconsin, along with in Michigan and the flagrant election fraud in North Carolina. What's being lost here is that the emphasis on the fact that the GOP legislative control in Wisconsin is also undemocratic. Last month, Democratic candidates received 54% of the votes in the state assembly elections, but they ended up with only 37% of the seats. So therein, we're back to 2010 and the gerrymandering, right? Is that this seems to be the lingering problem we have in this country. Even though the Democrats took the House, they lost the Senate, and the projections are that by the year 2040, 70 Senate seats will be controlled by Republicans from red states, and only 30 Senate seats will be controlled by Democrats, a majority of Democrats in blue states.
Mm-hmm. Look, what you're getting at there is sort of a core concept that is very rarely discussed in our politics, and that is that throughout the history of the American experiment, we have not taken the basic steps that are necessary to have a functional democracy. And you know, in a democracy, if it's reasonably well structured, even in a classic democratic republic, you want a legislative branch of government that is a relative reflection of the sentiments of the people, right? You know, where they're at. And the problem that we've got in the United States, both at the federal level and at the state level, is twofold. One, there are structural flaws, and those structural flaws are sort of summed up in the Electoral College and the U.S. Senate, you know, where you have small states with dramatically disproportionate representation, basically shutting down the majority of the people. And where that plays out is in something like the Kavanaugh fight, the battle over seating Brett Kavanaugh on the U.S. Supreme Court, where the senators representing the vast majority of Americans opposed putting Kavanaugh on the court. But he went on the court because senators representing a minority, these small states, were able to tip the balance. And we see it play out in tax policy, in just about every area you can imagine of governance. And so that's a big deal there. Then when you come down into the states, but also at the congressional level to some extent, you get the second side of it. So first, that structural flaw. you have the practical flaw that the way that we address our district lines, the way that we set up our elections, is to allow politicians to choose their voters. And that's really what happened in Wisconsin, as well as Michigan and a number of other states. After the 2010 election, which was a wave election for Republicans, they won a lot of state houses, the governorships, and control of state legislatures. They found themselves in a very strong position at precisely the right moment, and that is after the 2010 census came down. Legislatures were charged with redrawing state legislative boundaries, district lines across the country in each state. And in places like Wisconsin and Michigan, they knew that they had dumb-lucked into a position of power, that they happened to be in the right place at the right time, but that they wouldn't necessarily be there after the next election. And so they really engaged in something that was new. There'd always been gerrymandering. There's always been abuses of the redistricting process. But they engaged in a radical, highly funded, computer-assisted redrawing of legislative lines that was done with an eye toward developing a very sophisticated map that would re-elect Republicans even when people turned against Republicans. And that's what happened. It actually happened immediately. In 2012, the overwhelming vote in the state legislative elections in Wisconsin and state assembly elections was for Democrats, and yet Republicans kept control of the chamber. But it has really played out in 2018. In Wisconsin, for instance, almost 54% of people voted for Democratic candidates for the legislature, and yet in the state assembly, you ended up with 63% of the seats going to Republicans. So it's a complete warping of the process. And unfortunately, because of this, you know, sort of locked-in control of the legislature, even when the state in 2018 shifted dramatically against the Republicans, to the extent where Democrats won the U.S. Senate race, the governor's race, the lieutenant governor's race, the attorney general's race, the state treasurer's race, the secretary of state's race, for the first time winning all of those statewide contests since 1982, just a remarkable moment for the Democratic Party, they had virtually no progress in the legislature. And the outgoing governor, the defeated governor, Scott Walker, in collaboration with his longtime cronies in the legislature, have now conspired to use this ill-gotten political power in a sort of last-minute power grab to shift authority away from the newly elected governor over to the legislature. So the sins of 2010, 2011, and the gerrymandering continue to play out even after the Republicans have been quite overwhelmingly rejected.
So let's specifically talk about what the Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald have done. It's a very flagrant and crude move on their parts, and it surely will be challenged in the courts. But what exactly have they tried to push through?
Well, they tried a lot. They didn't get away with quite everything they wanted, but let's get specific about the things that they did do. They sought to disempower the governor by taking away the authority of the governor over some key appointments, i.e. Restructuring state boards and state oversight agencies in a way where traditionally the governor had had either an equal number of appointments or a majority. They moved that power over to the legislature. They also restructured oversight of specific areas and giving the legislature much more power than it had traditionally had, or at least had in recent years. And they took a host of executive orders, i.e., statements that Governor Walker, the outgoing Republican governor, had made on issues such as welfare policy and health care and even some criminal justice areas. And they said, well, no, that's those are no longer just executive orders. We're going to lock that in. We're going to, you know, basically pass laws that put that into a permanent form, so that the new Democratic governor, Tony Evers, can't simply issue executive orders undoing what Walker did. So they really did do a combination as regards the governor's office of, you know, disempowering the governor and taking areas of authority, you know, kind of out of his purview. They did something even more radical with the office of attorney general. They essentially said that the state attorney general would lose some lawyers, lose some authority, that the legislature itself would start to basically set up its own legal shop with lawyers representing the legislature when it wanted to do things, which is creates an absurdity. So you have a situation where the elected state attorney general might go into court with a lawyer arguing one thing, and then the legislature would have its own legal team there arguing something else, creating an incoherent sort of circumstance. But beyond that, they also said that the attorney general cannot enter into multi-state legal challenges, cannot do all sorts of legal initiatives that attorneys general in other states do and that they have traditionally done in Wisconsin without the permission of the legislature. So this combination, these two things, really move tremendous amount of power away from the statewide elected officials over to the legislature, even though this same legislature had moved power to its Republican allies when Walker was in charge and a Republican attorney general. Last final thing they did, just to note here also, is that they went after some voting rights protections. Essentially, their move was to limit early voting in Wisconsin. And early voting is a really key thing in Wisconsin. It's a very spread out state, and it's been used for, you know, quite a while. And there's some evidence that it does favor Democrats, you know, just because it's in the cities, especially, it's a place where a lot of people do participate in early voting. And so what the Republicans have done is take, you know, basically a six-week window with pretty liberal allowances for early voting and collapsed it down to 2 weeks with much more restriction on it. And, you know, this is, by any measure, this is simply an assault on high turnout elections. So those are the three kind of core elements.
Well, that's pretty bad. And again, I'm speaking.
It's really bad.
I'm speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation magazine's Washington correspondent, and he has an article at The Nation: The Impeachment of Donald Trump is No Longer Off the Table. You also had a recent article as well, John, titled "The Republican Party Has Become a Conspiracy to Seize Power," in which you quote Dwight David Eisenhower saying that, warning that, quote, "If a political party does not have its foundation in the determination to advance a cause that is right and that is moral, then it is not a political party. It is merely a conspiracy to seize power." So let's talk about the mindset. I mean, one of the most amazing things is that the Republican Party, the Tea Party, or they now call themselves the Freedom Caucus, is the tail that wags the dog of the GOP. And it's always struck me as extraordinary that a handful of radicals funded by the Koch brothers could basically take over the Republican Party. And conversely, one wonders why a group of progressives can't take over the Democratic Party. But it certainly happened on the far right. But they seem to be motivated, and Mark Meadows, their leader, might well be the next chief of staff in the White House. They seem to be, even though they're funded by plutocrats, they pretend to be populists, but in reality, they are very angry, poisonous people. And I wonder whether it has something to do with the psychological insecurity of essentially being whores and hirelings of the rich and powerful, pretending to represent their constituents. What explains this kind of junkyard dog viciousness of these people?
They know they're unpopular. I mean, it's really a simple equation. They're well aware that their ideas are not appealing, that they couldn't possibly win on the arguments that their ideas, that their approaches are useful, appropriate, sane. And so what they look for is opportunities to warp the political process on many, many different entry points. And this is important to understand. You refer to them as whores and hirelings, which I think might be a good title for a book. And of course, you do have this reality that they extend from the money power. They do things for money. They want to raise a lot of money, and so, for instance, you're confronted with the issue of climate change, and they deny it. They, you know, undermine efforts to address climate change. They extend from the fossil fuel lobby because it's beneficial to them at raising money at election time. And so, first and foremost, you've got that entry point, the money and politics entry point. But they don't stop there. Then they also have the media entry point. Of course, they have their allied and friendly media, you know, and we talk about it all the time, right-wing media, right-wing talk radio, you know, people will point to Fox News, all these different institutions. And they have created, in many ways, their own media bubble, their own media system. And that is obviously, in many cases, funded by wealthy folks, sustained by, you know, a sort of populist framing, but obviously underpinned by a constant reinforcement of the agenda of the elites. And yet they use that media, and that's another entry point, and it's often very effective. And then the final thing, which is less discussed but really important, is that they have adopted a winner-take-all approach to power once they get it. And we have a two-party system in the United States. We have a lot of instability in our politics and our governance, and so we have wave elections. Power moves back and forth from one party to the other. 2006, wave election for the Democrats. 2008, wave election for the Democrats. 2010, wave election for the Republicans. 2012, a wave election, relative wave election for the Democrats. 2014, wave election for the Republicans. 2016, a very unstable, close election, but one that ultimately gave power to the Republicans. 2018, wave election for the Democrats. You start to get a picture here, flipping back and forth, power going back and forth between the parties. That occasionally gives this group of Republicans, this winner-take-all group, power at a pivotal moment, at a critical juncture. When they get it, unlike in the past where they just simply might seek to advance a conservative agenda on a host of issues, they also seek structural change. They seek to change voting laws. They seek to change, obviously, district lines via gerrymandering and other interventions. They seek to even change, as they did in Wisconsin, and one of their proposals, which they got beaten back on this time, is to change election dates because an election might draw a high turnout. And so in Wisconsin, for instance, the 2020 state Supreme Court race, very critical to the conservatives, was on the same day as the Wisconsin presidential primary, which, because the Democrats are in opposition, was likely to attract a lot of Democrats. And so they tried to change the primary election date away from with the Supreme Court election date, so they'd get a lower turnout election. And the way to understand this is that these are people, as I said at the beginning, who fully understand their ideas and their candidates are not popular. They cannot compete in, you know, straight up, honest, fair, high turnout election. So they're kind of always looking for ways, A, to warp the debate with money and politics, with media interventions, or B, to warp the process so that they don't have to face the reality of an election in which their ideas are put before a great mass of people, and the great mass of people say, well, we don't like that.
But just in the last minute, John Nichols, what explains this totalitarian impulse, this authoritarian power grab, the idea that American politics were always, with the duopoly that we have, one party would win and the other would lose, and the losing party would go off and lick their wounds and come back 2 years or 4 years later with a better argument. But they let the other side govern. The idea that you don't let the other side govern, you do everything to sabotage them. It's a totalitarian authoritarian impulse that they're acting on. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether the extraordinary op-ed by 44 senators, many retired senators, many of them very prominent Republicans, warning about the state of American politics. I think they're clearly concerned about the person in the White House, but they also seem to be concerned about our government in general and our United States Senate.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, there's no other way to say it, but the fact of the matter is that the period we've entered into is one that exposes the vulnerabilities of our system. We've started to realize that you can lose the popular vote by a massive number of votes and still become president of the United States because of the Electoral College. We've started to realize that you can maintain something akin to permanent control of the U.S. Senate because of the way that the Senate is constituted via small states, and, you know, or with small states having disproportional influence. At the same time, there has been this realization that you can abuse gerrymandering and money in politics to get the upper hand. And you refer to it as a totalitarian or authoritarian impulse, and I think that it's appropriate to use those terms. But what I would suggest to you is that many of these players, many of these Republican players, are simply pathetic people. They are tragic, ineffectual losers as regards politics. They're not good at what they do. And so they recognize that the way to prevail is to cheat. And it is simply easier for them to cheat, i.e. to gerrymander, to use all these other strategies, than it is to actually compete on the basis of ideas. And I would simply suggest to you, as somebody who's covered politics for a very long time, this is not what the Republican Party was historically about. This is not what conservatism was historically about. I think Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan would be horrified by the people who now operate in their name. And I'm not a big defender of Goldwater or Reagan, but what I am suggesting is that Goldwater, Reagan, for all their flaws, they felt they were advancing a set of ideas, and they figured out over time how to push those ideas more aggressively, and to some extent with Reagan more effectively. These people, I think, have given up. The people who run the Republican Party now have given up on the battle of ideas. They know their ideas are lousy. They know that they don't sell, and so they have gone toward what to them seems the easiest route to maintaining power, and that is cheating.
Well, John Nichols, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I appreciate it. It's a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
And again, I'll be speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And his latest book with Robert McChesney is Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. And he has an article at The Nation, The Impeachment of Donald Trump is No Longer Off the Table. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved. The headline.